which was a lot, and there the Jews were a lot better off at that time. Here, probably with Malachi as the background, shows that a somewhat cynical spirit had taken possession of the Israelites, a spirit that led them to question whether the love of God, which the fathers had claimed for Israel, that, you know, you're the chosen people, God loves you, and they're wondering, is this a fantasy you're talking about, or is it really a reality? So Ecclesiastes is addressing this. What the preacher offers shows them how to evaluate the difficulty and how to overcome the dangers that grow out of it. The background of the chapter is the troubled age after the exile, and this might be borne in mind that is needed in a consideration of all the preceding chapters. But we're going to come out of it as we see chapters 10, 11, and 12 in the conclusion of this book. Very positive, very upbeat. In fact, even in this chapter, it's going to leave us on a good note. The first part of this context, we're just looking at half the chapter, verses 1 through 6, sketches the difficulty that the author seeks to meet. And the second part of the context, verses 7 through 10, suggests the spirit in which the difficulty is to be met. So it's going to give us help in how to view life and with that attitude to deal with it. So Ecclesiastes 9 verse 1, the writer says, I have taken all this to my heart and explained it that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hate, anything awaits him. So this passage begins with 4, a referencing back to the former context, and should probably be taken in that connection. But this section is closely akin to the preceding material, so the verse makes kind of bridge, you know, from the previous context into this one, so it's fine just to leave, you know, verse 1 where it is in the 9th chapter. The author is delving deeply into the issues former and upcoming, which he is taking to heart. Thus, expression that means he's looking closer into the future for the Israelites to see how he can help them. The matter being explored is the deeds of the righteous and wise man being in the hands of God. The rest of the verse shows what he means specifically about that, what he's intended. Although God's sovereignty is strongly stressed, okay, it's not overly stressed. That is, this is not determinism, as though everything is a result beyond human will, or that God's will completely override everything. There's still human will. You know, this is what God has given us. You know, we have to learn to work with God, but you know, you have a choice of which way you want to go, with him or against him. The sense may be from this, from the manner in which things happen in this life, a man cannot tell whether God's attitude toward him is one of love or hate. Do you ever feel that God hates you sometimes? I've heard people say this. The last phrase going along with this means practically anything can happen. So in verse 2, goes along with this. It's developing this theme. It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. To properly understand the thinking of Koheleth, the preacher here, one needs to understand the term fate. And it's not the way we use it. Okay, the Hebrew word, makrab, means to meet, or simply that which befalls one. Okay, so whatever happens, it is not used in opposition to deny divine ordainment. The term is used in opposition to independent action on the part of the righteous, or rather to man's control of things that shall befall them. There's a lot of things that happen to us we can't control. They come. In fact, if you want a New Testament parallel, what he's going through is, you know, we're looking at, and we'll get into this, you know, with this phrase, life under the sun. This is the life that happens to everybody, Christian or whatever. Matthew 5, 44, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. You know, the sun shines on, you know, the just or the unjust. So, yeah, in this case, you know, there are things that God does that takes care of everybody. I mean, we want it that, you know, good weather is on us all the time and bad weather is on the evil people, but it just doesn't happen that way. Okay? So, you know, in that spectrum, okay, we're all kind of got to deal with, you know, whatever comes. You know, God's blessings and sometimes God's anger. Although for the people of God, there is a higher level of living where you have perks, blessings, protection, and everything else. But we're not quite there yet. You know, the writer is trying to get us up there or consider that. But right now he's just going, you know, in this spectrum under the sun where everybody's going to deal with the same things, the Christian can still shine or enjoy life. Other people don't. So the mercenary spirit expects either prompt reward or swift justice for appropriate actions. Okay, you know, we want God to do something. You know, think of Jonah, you know, hoping God would strike the Ninevites. Okay, it didn't happen. All right? However, what often befalls, that word fate, nekra, may be identical in the short run because men do not discern the obvious way that God eventually treats them. Okay? We know no matter what happens now, God in divine judgment, you know, in the end, is going to sort it all out. Okay? But even in this life, God takes a hand. You know? And again, it's just being patient with him. The three categories of the righteous involve, one, those who are sincere in observation of ceremonial demands and are the most exact in observing what the law describes. So that's that part, opposed to the one who just doesn't care what God's law says, doesn't sacrifice, doesn't do anything. Two, those who live really good lives, that's opposed to the sinner who just doesn't care about God, you know, whatever, just going to do what he wants to do. And those who realize that the true import of an oath and would dare to use it only in the true fear of God. You know, being careful what comes out of their mouth and what they're committing themselves to, as opposed to the one who could care less what he swears or, you know, who he reviles. This is an evil, and all that is done, again, under the sun, that expression that goes through this, that there is one fate for all men. Okay? Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. Note again that the reason for such philosophical shallowness is the lack of any consideration of the illuminating higher values. You know, where God's people can plug things in and see something extra in life. Okay, we're just dealing with them as they live among men. Again, factors that are done under the sun. This viewpoint is evil because it ignores the just judge of all mankind who ultimately sets everything right. They're going, you know, God's not ruling, God's not taking care of anything, why doesn't he do something? They're railing against God. Okay, and so it's as if, you know, their heart is full of evil. It's an evil position to take, you know, where the godly people trust him. They know he's going to sort everything out, you know, even in this life. Because men routinely leave this consideration out, their hearts are viewed as full of evil. This course of life is also termed insanity. We covered it in a couple of chapters back. That is, the term means blind to true issues, because it leads men into a life of evil and business as usual. After that, to the dead. Notice, not just death, but to the dead. Okay, there's a reason for that expression. But also because, you know, your viewpoint matters. This is something that the scriptures bring out over and over again. Be careful what you're thinking. Okay? Whatever your philosophy is, the way, whatever you picture life to be, however you think things are run, whatever you believe to be true or false, it will affect your actions. You know, and that's, your actions make you what you are. So there are always consequences to even the way we think. So Kuhila back then is going, you know, be careful. You know, if you live in a life, you know, you live a life where you think God is not in it, you're walking in the world blind. Consider the consequences. Challenge you. Next time, tomorrow morning when you get up, either go to school or, you know, go to work, start off by getting out of bed with your eyes closed and keep them closed through the whole day. You know, when you're crossing the street, when you're getting in your car to drive away, just keep your eyes closed and see what happens. Okay, it's a very graphic picture, but that's the way most people live life. Going through it, not knowing really how life works and what's important, you know, and what the outcome is going to be of certain things. For whoever is joined with the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. This explains, you know, the end of the dead thing. Here it seems that the author backs up for a moment to picture where men under the sun have hope, only as long as they're living. That's all he's saying. Okay? So while you're still alive, you can listen. It's time to start thinking these things out. He's already talked about, you know, better to go to the house of the dead than to, you know, go to a party, because it gets you to start thinking about things. You see where eventually we'll all end up. So you got things to take care of. Get it done now while you still have time. To illustrate this, a proverbial statement of such men is quoted. Today we say, where there is life, there's hope. Okay. Saying the same thing, basically, it's better to be a live dog, because a live dog's got a chance. A dead lion doesn't. Okay. For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Okay. So dwelling still on this thought, the author states that a living person has the distinct advantage of knowing that he will die and be able to arrange many a thing in his life to prepare for the issues. But for the dead, every opportunity for action or achievement of any sort is a thing of the past. Okay, now, it needs to be pointed out at this time. Okay? This is not a flat denial of all hope of an ever after. He's just dealing with things under the sun, and what it seems, when the dead go, they'll be no longer having any chance. Okay? It's not telling us about an afterlife. It hasn't even got there. So if somebody decides to, you know, to pull this passage out and go, well, you see, there's nothing after we're dead, you miss the rest of the scriptures. Okay. The dead do not know anything. This is not Calibus' definite opinion about the state of the dead in the other world. He is only expressing the relationship of the dead to this world, as he continues on in the next verse. Indeed, their love, their hate, their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. Now, not in God's heaven, not in after judgment, in eternal punishment, whatever. He's not going there. He's just trying to get people to wake up now, okay, and look at things. Under the sun, how can death appear if higher values and possibilities are disregarded? And once you plug in everything that God can plug into life, you've got a whole different ballgame. And you've got advantages in this life, and you're looking forward to a far better life. You know, that's what we get out of a lot of the New Testament. We know that's, you know, Paul stated, Philippians, you know, to stay here and be beneficial to the Philippians, or to go on and be with Christ. Hard decision. Hard decision. Because there was something better waiting. Okay. To such individuals, death is the termination of all things concerning love, hate, and zeal. To God's people, though, such things are not only continue, but these great values of life take on eternal qualities. You know, the bit of love and hate and zeal that we have here, you know, the love is going to increase in the afterlife. You know, zeal and working for God is going to increase. When we truly see how magnificent He is, how wonderful He is, how much He loves us, you know, we're going to be, you know, even more gung-ho to do anything we can for Him. Okay, another section here, the last four verses. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. These last four verses suggest the spirit in which difficult times should be met. Now we're getting into the attitude. The preacher chooses to stay at the lower level for clarity. As the Apostle Paul used to say in some of his letters, I speak in human terms. Okay, on a level you can understand. This is what Cohelius is doing. Go then is a directive to be up and doing over against the tendency to brood and to ponder over vexatious problems. And what he's, if you ever know the life of Winston Churchill, it was not easy. In fact, as a young person, his parents dropped him off at, you know, boarding schools. And during breaks and stuff like that, when all the other kids went home, he stayed because his parents were off doing something else. He had no place to go. It's the kind of life he grew up in, very lonely. And then he had the thankless job of being, you know, prime minister during World War II. You know, the difficult job of deciding, in many cases, who's going to live, who's going to die. You know, enemies being made in all places. But one of the statements he made, he says, I'm an optimist. There's no use to being anything else. And you think about it. Okay? As you look at life, you know, are there times that it's going to be tough? Are there times you're going to fail? Wow, welcome to the club. You know, that's part of life. But if you never try anything, of course you're never going to accomplish anything. I mean, there's people whose life are nothing but failure. If you look at during the Civil War, the two most prominent and you might think successful men during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant. Through most of their life, these guys were the biggest failures you'll ever run into. Especially Lincoln, man, he failed at everything. He failed at running a store, he failed at law school, failed at being a senator, whatever. But the only thing he's successful at is being one of the best presidents we had, and they shot him. but if you don't try, what are you going to do? Sit in a corner and mope and cry, and worry about everything. I mean, it could get down to, I don't want to eat anything; it might be poison. Well, you're going to die anyway if you don't eat. Don't breathe because it might be pollution in the air. Well, try not breathing for a while. Being a pessimist is a no-win situation, definitely. So you might as well be optimistic, especially as a Christian, when you know God's behind you. Go out and take on the world. Okay. Already covered is the position that to eat bread and to drink wine is not an Epicurean philosophy. Probably every drunk knows these passages in Ecclesiastes, but he's not saying that. He's just going to enjoy life. I mean, you kind of look forward to, dinner time, especially if you have a long day, you've been working, and the food really tastes good. Why do you think it tastes good? Because God made it that way. He made it so that you have aesthetic qualities. Your taste, your sight, there's things that are pleasing to the sight, there's things that feel good to the touch. All these little things, sometimes we just completely overlook if we just take time to enjoy a sunset, breathe fresh air, smell the pine trees. Just, there's a world out there, that God has given us to enjoy. Plus the friendships, that we make as people. These are all God's gifts to us. So go out and enjoy these things. Anybody can do this. This is, one of the advantages that God has given, this viewpoint, this insight. With a merry heart, it actually implies that these are gifts of God to be rightly appreciated. From every point of view, it is a better policy to enjoy what may be enjoyed than to brood over insoluble difficulties. Unfortunately, men seem to ignore this advice because to the world, the blind, it does not appear to be a particularly bright solution. Oh, it's too simple. Just do it. Sounds like a Nike commercial. Why not? Instead of there building up a psychological problem, just go enjoy life. The life that God meant for you to, not something man has made up to be detrimental. The author has impressed this cheerful heart upon the readers. Notice, he brought it up in chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 8. He's trying to drive it into us. You're complaining too much. Life can be sweet. Savor it. Why do you think God gave it to us? When he created everything, he said it was good. Find out what he meant. There's an added motivation, though, and an uplifting thought for the mind. God has already approved your works. Okay? To the righteous man, he says, to the righteous man, you may be sure that God has already taken a sincere delight in all your works done in righteousness. Okay? New Testament, your toil is not in vain. We just got through looking at that. Okay? Whatever you put out there for God, whatever good you're trying to do in this world, God has taken note of every last little thing. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Additional thoughts are added on how to cultivate good cheer. As many commentators concede, white is a sign of cheerfulness and joy, not just white garments being emblems of purity and festivity, which you find in Revelation, the book of Revelation, but also they're used as signs of cheerfulness and joy. This is what God says. You know, let your demeanor be one of cheerful and joy. You'll be surprised how many more people you'll meet and make friends with because your attitude is cheerful and joyous. Okay? You'll be surprised how many people you turn away when you're just a sourpuss. Mm-hmm. The use of oil is also a symbol of joy. In fact, it's termed an oil of joy. Psalms 45:8, Isaiah 61:3, as opposed to letting the hair grow unkempt or the face unwashed as signs of grief. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, fasting, whatever. Fasting was not commanded under the law of Moses. Okay, it's something you find. It was incorporated by the people, and God had to regulate it after a while. And finally, he got so tired of it, he said, you know, the fasting I want is not this unwashed face and sitting in ashes and behaving like, you know, some sort of ninny all day long where people don't want to be around you. Rather, you know, he goes into, here's fasting. Visit the fatherless, the widows, make sure justice is done. That's the kind of fasting he wants. And if you have to sacrifice something for the good of others. That's true fasting. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in heaven and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. The preacher also knew that a good gift a true wife is. Okay? The marriage law was one of the first laws we had. Before Christianity, before Judaism, there was the marriage law. Okay? Spouse, especially guys, a wife is God's gift to you. And this is where Eve came from. God's gift to Adam was Eve. Okay? Sometimes we need to stop and think about that. Look at your spouse and go, this is God's gift to me. And sometimes it doesn't seem like that, but you'll be a better person in the long run after, you know, whatever. This is what you... the wife is really the one that will know you better than anyone. It can be a true friend, you know, who shares a lot of the problems with you, a lot of the challenges of life, you know, there with you as a partner. That's what the way God meant, and especially during tough times. So men are bidden to cheerfully enter into a pleasant state of matrimony. If your matrimony doesn't seem that pleasant, I might suggest perhaps you went about it the wrong way. I think the way Western civilization approaches dating and everything needs to be reconstructed or rethought out. We start dating too soon before we have foundational things done. I mean, if you haven't got, you know, done with your schooling and you haven't got a good job, you got no business, you know, trying to connect with another person. All you're going to do is do something wrong or bad. Unless you think you can remain friends for a long time to get it all done. Other than that, you've got other priorities that you'll get sidetracked if you start dating too early. Also, it may seem that arranged marriages are just something that shouldn't be done, but I'm beginning to rethink it. Having some older people, you know, who have been through it, kind of assess the partner. One of the things I learned when I was younger is someone told me that, you know, whoever you're going to marry, first introduce her to your sisters. You know, they will see through all the facade, everything else, and let you know what she's really like. Okay? But why don't we do that? You know, letting the parents pick. You may think this is weird. You know, this is not Hollywood love. You know, love at first sight, whatever. Biblical examples. Adam loved Eve the first time he saw her. Once you got a right attitude, you'll make it work. Okay, what about Isaac, you know, and his wife arranged? Over in India, visiting with Joshua and his wife Aruna, it's arranged marriage. Most marriages in India are arranged. You know what the divorce rate is? As opposed to, oh, I know I'm in love with him in, you know, Western civilization, our divorce rate is about 50%. If that good. And perhaps he, again, got to rethink it, you know, and see, you know, thinking with the head, not just, you know, with other parts of anatomy. Although this is a time of struggle for them, more extreme circumstances might offer up a more contrary advice to this. Case in point, but these I think are unique instances where Jeremiah was forbidden to take a wife because of the problems. And during the present distress, Paul's opinion was not to take a wife if one did not already have one, 1 Corinthians 7. But, you know, it depends on the wife. You know, choose wisely, my son. Okay. Note that a true wife is one given by God. That's the best part, you know, about this passage. It's God's gift to you. So, whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might, for there is no activity in planning or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. Finally, the author adds that a relaxed attitude, a drifting along, is not advocated. A lot of people just want to slide through life, Lotharios, you know, just kind of drifting from one place to another. Just, that's not what you're here for. You know, that's not going to make you happy. It'll make you old fast and have your life be pointless. Along with, you know, this defeatist attitude. The emphasis on whatever your hand finds to do is not about being energetic about everything. Okay, there's a focus here. It is more exclusively about exercising the strengths that God has given one. See, in this life to enjoy, He's given you things inside of yourself in order to extract from life the things that will make it, you know, even better. Okay? This is why, okay, these Hebrew words, these would be the happy faculties that a man possesses for doing work. Okay? You find a man who is really good at what he does, and he knows he's building something lasting and for somebody else, he's very happy what he does. He's satisfied. Whatever work you're assigned to, try, you know, putting a spin on it. Try to find something about it that'll make it pleasant or worthwhile. And you can find that. Also, words for devising new things. God has given us a sense of creativity, you know, an ability to imagine things greater than what we're looking at and to build toward that. You know, we carve out, you know, wildernesses. You know, we build empires. This is one of the great things that God has given us. Be careful which way you take that, though. And that's for employing the knowledge that we've accumulated. You have an ability to store facts. Be careful of the facts you put in there. And use those facts for either good or bad efforts. But you want to do it for employing constructive knowledge that is ethically motivated. Align up your life and your very being, all the things that God has given you, skills, talents, whatever, opportunities, you know, and make the most for God. And He will make sure that your life turns out far better than you'd ever imagine. Under the sun, there's no activity, planning, or wisdom when one enters into the afterlife, Sheol. But even Jesus remarked that we must work the works of Him that sent me. While it is day, the night comes when no man can work. So now's your opportunity. Now, you're preparing yourself to meet your God. What kind of life are you going to present to Him? What are you going to hand over to Him? Something worthless? Something unused? Something not fruitful? Or something powerfully modeled and motivated in service to Him. Thus, this section comes to an end on a positive note and a call to action. Okay, now, the writer's getting into this. You know, now he's covered, the problems and everything. Now he's starting to swing this thing in a more positive direction. You know, to really show us where we can construct life and enter into life to get the very most out of it. And of course, that comes with the conclusion in chapter 12, the whole of man, his whole purpose, to fear God and keep his commandments. That's where he's headed. And notice, he's got two or three chapters to fill in between here and that conclusion, the end of chapter 12. Okay. Oh, we're about to sing number 318. And a very quick question. The title of this, Where Livest Thou? That's the primary question it's asking through this song that we need to think about. You know, where do you live? You know, where is your heart? You know, is it in the world, or is it starting to think about what it can be doing for God? Along with this, and it kind of gets close to that, is the second question, where are you going to end up? You know, where are you going to be living after this life is over? The answer to the first question will determine the answer to the second. And this is what we're here for, and what God calls us for, is to get us prepared for the right answer in both of these. And we're here as a church, God's body, in order to help one another do this. So if there's any kind of counseling that you need, any kind of help, any kind of prayers, you know, whatever it takes, it's before Sheol sets in, before the grave, before the dead lion shows up on your doorstep, now's the time to make all the preparation. Now's the time to get your house in order, your life in order, and prepare to meet your God. Won't you come as we stand to sing?